We could try to explain what it's like to get your work done on a John Deere mower, compact tractor, or Gator XUV. But to really understand the feeling, you just have to get in the seat. Learn more at johndeere.com/get in the seat or visit a dealer near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, folks. I am John Najarian from MarketRebellion.com, and this is Compound Interests. On today's show, I'm going to be speaking with Scott Ladner. Scott does a great job describing what dispersion trading is, and don't just let that like roll over you. Dispersion trading is not as difficult to understand as you think. It is, for instance, taking that higher volatility unit, which might be an index, and then the constituents, the stocks that make up that index, and trading one against the other and capturing the edge that is apparent in perhaps that index being a little higher volatility than is justifiable, and then capturing and having a hedge on against that on the other side of those constituent stocks. He's going to talk about volatility. He's going to talk about exactly what goes on when a $6 billion portfolio gets moved around in the markets and how it impacts the markets and your money. It's a great conversation. I encourage you to listen. I know you're going to enjoy today's Compound Interests.
Hey, John, thank you very much.
I am pretty excited because I've known the guys at Wallach Beth. In particular, of course, Andy McOrmond, but David Beth and Mike Wallach. I've known a lot of the guys on the team there for quite a while. And, you know, during our discussion, we'll probably get into a little bit about what they do, but they are a broker's broker. They basically find liquidity where firms like Horizon are looking for it, you know, whether that's liquidity to get into a position or liquidity to get out to make it less, you know, that friction is always something that you and I worry about, right, Scott?
No doubt, yeah, and you know, a firm like that is really important to a firm like ours because infrastructure is required to do a really good job trading ETFs and trading those types of securities is pretty massive. And they can access the different players in the industry and really be able to kind of match things up in a pretty intelligent way, in a pretty seamless way. So the, you know, the value they create for a firm like ours is pretty massive. We love them.
Yep, well, for those folks who don't know, Scott, you guys are based out on the East Coast, I believe, still in the Charlotte area?
We are, yep, and the hurricane missed us, so we're in good shape.
Thank goodness. Knock on wood. That looked like it was pretty bad when it was heading towards the Carolinas, but it, like you say, it missed you and or it just kind of burned out. It got all the way down to a Category 1, I guess. And now it's, yep. Is it still a Cat 1 or is it just a tropical storm?
I think it's just a storm right now heading up the coast. But yeah, nothing, some wind, some rain, but nothing too bad for us.
Now, who typically, Scott, would be the sort of party that would be giving Horizon money to manage? I mean, is it individual investors? Is it all endowments and institutions? Give us kind of a breakdown of sort of the minimums as well as the sorts of, parties that you guys deal with.
Right. So we're actually our clients are actually financial advisors. And so ultimately, you know, clients are folks like my parents, like my mom. But we don't actually deal with mom in the end story. We deal with their financial advisor for the most part. And so, you know, we do have institutional money. We do have other types of clients, but our bread and butter business really is the advisory business. And you know, ultimately people that are their clients.
So then, these FAs or financial advisors that are out there, they rely on you guys because, number one, you guys have a strategy that you employ. Number two, a lot of those FAs might not have quite the derivative expertise that you guys have over at Horizon. Not that that's 100% of your trading every day, but obviously it's not every shop that has that derivative expertise. There are a few of you guys or of us, since I'm an advisor over at our own firm for that. I don't actually touch customer money at all for a whole variety of reasons, Scott, because it would impair my ability to talk about it on television and all that sort of thing. But nonetheless, you ran a dispersion book when you were over at Peak Six. Can you give the people watching and listening at home a little idea of what a dispersion book is? It sounds like something that's really complicated, and it is, but it's also something that's not that difficult to understand when an expert explains it.
Yeah, that's right. So a dispersion book, or a volatility dispersion book, is really a type of trading strategy, a type of derivative strategy that's based on the differences between the implied volatility or the option price of an index versus the option price or the implied volatility of the constituents of that index. And the long story short, the implied volatility of the index is generally going to be higher than sort of the weighted sum of the component parts, and so it's generally because of correlation factors involved with how these things work. And so generally, what you're doing with a dispersion book is you're selling volatility on the index and buying volatility on the component parts, and you tend to make money kind of slowly over time in a strategy like that. The risk you're exposed to in a strategy like that, though, is a spike in correlations like we just saw in March. And so, that kind of trading activity can be very, very damaging to correlation books or to dispersion strategies, broadly speaking. And so, it can be a really, really kind of fun strategy to run, or a really nice strategy to run. But just knowing what the risks are going into it, it's always important. There's no free money out there, as we well know.
Yep. Well, maybe give us an idea, if you could, Scott, when that March volatility did spike, when we got up to 80 for the VIX and so forth. During the peak of that fear, oh my God, we're all locked down, the economy's shut down, what's gonna go on? Nobody's flying, cruise lines are shuttered, maybe they're all going bankrupt, airlines and cruise lines and so forth. Thank God that's behind us, but when that was going on, did that create some great spread opportunities for you in exactly that kind of strategy that you just outlined?
Yeah, I mean, it would, assuming that you end up having the capacity to stick with it. One of the main things with a strategy like that, or with any kind of generally volatility selling strategy or short correlation strategy, is the ability to stick with it when things get tough. So that the amount of capital that you have associated with that is kind of the determining factor about whether or not you can stick with it or not. But these types of opportunities obviously don't come around very often. So if you do have the staying power to get through it, it can make for some really compelling opportunities. But seeing the treasury market cease functioning again, and seeing other things we saw like we did in March, hopefully it's not going to happen again for a little while, just for everybody's ability to sleep at night standpoint. But when they do come around, it's nice to have some dry powder.
Oh yeah. And, I'm sure some of those spreads were as wide as you'd seen them in a while, because of exactly what you described at the top, Scott, about, being short index vol against the constituent stocks that make up that index. Now, how focused down to a group of stocks do you guys get when you're trading an ETF, for instance? Do you get down into the 10 stock ETFs and things like that, some of the spiders? And so forth. Obviously, the spider itself for the S&P 500 is one thing, but when you're talking about, the IWM or the XLF or, some of these others, obviously IWM's 2,000 stocks, that's the small cap index, the Russell. When you get down to a 10 stock index or even less, that's got to make that dispersion trading a little more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly things you can do to offset that, but it's, you obviously can't trade options on 2,000 stocks, and so you end up picking baskets of things that you can actually functionally deal with. That specific kind of trading strategy isn't something that we do a ton of at Horizon, but we do use a lot of the metrics that you would employ for running those types of strategies. So, for instance, a metric called implied correlation can be a very important kind of very telling metric for how much does the market how much is the index option market, how much are vol players really worried about a spike in correlations, really worried about a spike in vol? That implied correlation metric, which you can derive from the index option prices and from the constituent part prices of those options, you know, that implied correlation metric was actually above 100 for a couple of days there in March. So obviously you can't go and get correlations over 100. That's telling you that there's some real severe market stress involved in particularly the price of index options, which is just telling you that folks are running for the exits as fast as possible. That kind of information can be really useful when running strategies like we run.
Yeah, that liquidation in March was pretty horrific. And even some of the rallies subsequent to that, we saw some just, you know, those knee-jerk 1,000-point or 1,800-point moves. And regardless of how seasoned the investor was, that has to be something that, you know, you guys, were you doing a lot of hand-holding during that time? When the, you know, FAs are calling you up saying, we've still got our money, right? You know, we've still got money. We're not broke, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when things get fast, we talk a lot. In terms of handholding, because that's important, right? I mean, we're all pros. We do this for a living. This is all we do. Mom just looks at the TV, freaks out, and calls her financial advisor, freaked out, and then advisor freaks out because they're dealing with 100 such clients. And so, active outward-facing communication when we're in fast markets like that ends up being a really large value add we can give, because when you can turn something that's very uncertain and provide some context and provide some understanding and just like plain vanilla stuff, plain vanilla the way that, like, this is why this stuff is happening. Here's what we're looking for. Here's what you need to be aware of. Here's why you shouldn't be panicking and really kind of doing something silly with the portfolio or selling out or doing, you know, just making other types of, you know, decisions that we know are going to be probably in hindsight, this is like a week or two later, wrong. Just providing, you know, being able to provide some context and some intelligence around some of these events and what's really driving them and what we're looking for normalization purposes ends up being a pretty useful spot. Our technology tools that we actually have on the site too, which actually allow advisors to go in and take a look at each one of their portfolios, and actually we have some hedging strategies that we've got that are pretty popular. They can actually go in on a daily basis and see how far away their portfolios are from being hedged, or what percentage they are hedged, when they're going to get unhedged. All those types of metrics can be really settling when clients get freaked out, because what you need to provide when things are very uncertain is a modicum of certainty and some rationale. And if you can do that, you get people to calm down and reduce the behavioral biases that we know can really be destructive to their financial plans.
Well, Scott, can you tell us a little bit about AUM, about the assets that Horizon manages? And again, folks, he's already explained that these assets are coming to them through financial advisors. And those financial advisors are counting on Horizon to then manage the funds when they hand them over. And you guys are giving them, do you guys offer monthly liquidity, or what is the liquidity cycle that you guys can offer? And then get into the AUM part of that question, Scott.
Yeah, so we actually offer it's daily liquidity, because everything that we do is in public markets. So we run, there's eight mutual funds that we run. There's a couple of ETFs, or three ETFs now that we sub-advise, and we do a lot of things in separately managed accounts. It is daily liquidity. We don't do anything in private markets right now. We run a little over $6 billion, and it's grown very quickly. The way that we look at the world, and the way that we deal with the investment problems that mom and dad have is very intuitive. Is very different. It's still fairly sophisticated, but it's different than the way that they're used to being talked to. And so that goals-based approach, or that kind of outcome-based approach, has been pretty powerful in gathering assets and sort of telling our story and making the complex simple again.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously that growth is pretty phenomenal to get up to 6 billion assets under management. And that's between, as you say, the advice that you offer for those three ETFs, as well as the eight mutual funds, Scott?
Eight mutual funds. Yep. Yeah. Eight mutual funds, and so between the mutual funds and the ETFs, that's about $2.5 billion, and then the remainder is then separately managed account models.
Fantastic. When that volatility was spiking in March, and you guys were looking to commit capital, that's that. You know, I'm not saying buy the dip for that, even though I do buy dips a lot. But you guys are, you know, getting calls all the time from either people redeeming and pulling some money out for a host of reasons. Hopefully not too much of it was fear-based back in March. But by the way, what sort of conversations did you have with FAs who were calling you up? There's my dog, Dexter. What sort of conversations were you guys having at the depths of the crisis in March? Do you think maybe 10% of the assets were folks that were just liquidating and getting out, or was it even less than that?
It was well, for our particular book, it was less than that. We were net flow positive every month this year, and so, you know, we've been adding assets every month this year, and I do think, John, a lot of it is because of the certainty that we can provide for folks, and the tools that we can, the transparency with which we do things, and the way that we can solve people's problems in a pretty coherent, intelligent way. And be very proactive in the communication part. That's, as I know you know very well, like, when things get tough, you got to be really actively communicating with your client base, because people are just scared. They don't know what's going on. They've got a lot of questions. And the more you can be out there saying, here's what's going on, here's why it's going on, here's what we're looking for resolution, the more you can tell that story and be able to be cogent about it, the more you're going to get people, the more you're going to earn trust. And, you know, like, the, and trust is such an important thing for a money manager to have, and something that we value deeply. But something that we think we gained a lot of over the last 6 months, just with what's happened and how we've handled it.
Well, my hat's off to you, because I know that when stuff's hitting the fan, I know our wealth managers over at the firm, what they rely on a lot is when customers are calling up and they're worried, they know they should be almost doubling down on investments, because, you know, it's such a reverse indicator. If the customers want to take on more risk, our guys want to take it off, because they say, man, you know, and it's not as simple, Scott, as fear and greed, but it is, you know, people, when they get that FOMO, that fear of missing out, and they're sitting there saying, man, why do we have any of these hedges on, guys? Why have you guys written calls against this stuff? You know, it just goes up every day. And our guys are like, it's probably time for us to be owning put spreads too, if these guys want me to lift my call hedges and so forth. But that's really, this year should be something that you guys could basically put out a pamphlet about to all the FAs, as far as if you were adding money during that time, during that March drawdown, rather than having people saying, you know, hey, I'm just really too nervous, I need to get out. It might point to, Scott, one of the benefits of having a financial advisor, because that's one more person between the ma or pa sitting at home and the person committing that capital, you, because there's a filter in between, that financial advisor who hopefully has enough experience in the markets not to be just blown out and so fearful at the bottom, and instead looking at it and saying, this is an opportunity, guys, this is an opportunity, this is not the time to be liquidating.
Well, and you're exactly right, John, because, you know, as you know, like, financial advisors have, what is it, 3 dozen jobs they have to do all simultaneously. Managing money is one of them. I mean, you know, like, managing the assets is just one part of it. And so that's why, you know, that's why our clients are, you know, and the advisors that work with us, that's generally why they come to us. They say, listen, we can't spend the kind of time that you guys, like, this is all we do. This is all Horizon does. And, you know, is look at markets, make decisions, and manage portfolios. And the financial advisors have to do tax planning, financial planning, investments, client acquisition, holding hands, the quarterly meetings. So, like, there's a slew of stuff that they've got to take care of, and we know that. So, you know, just having the amount of, you know, the amount of eyes looking at the markets and making determinations about what's going on and how to interpret sort of the vast array of data that are available today, it's just one less thing they have to do. And again, that's where the trust part comes in, right? If they can sit back and they can watch how you perform and watch how you do through a crisis like this, it will build. It ends up building a lot of trust between the advisor and a firm like ours. You can use that going forward, because they know that if things get really tough, they know they can call you. You know you're going to be communicative. They know that our job is really to give them words to say to their clients. It's to provide information in a context in a way that is useful to them, like both as professionals in the money management industry, but also as client-facing people and, you know, as handholders sometimes. Getting those words to folks to say is a pretty large value, we think, and it's, you know, hopefully that'll bear out in the coming months.
I'm sure it will. Do you guys, I don't know with any of the mutual funds that you guys are very big in the metals, are you?
We don't. We use metal stuff we analyze metals and we look at that market. It's not something we invest a ton in, but man, they are been super interesting lately.
Yeah. I highlighted just a little bit ago how those miners like that GDX and so forth, how well that's done versus just the straight GLD. The GDX folks, for those who are not as versed in it, is the miners. There's a GDXJ, which is junior miners. As well.
But, juicy miners.
Yes.
The J stands for juicy.
But I mean, oh my gosh, that the performance just in the last, I mean, here we are talking on the 5th of August, and we just hit another high, another all-time high for gold in U.S. dollar terms. I got to throw that in there because otherwise Gartman will email me and tell me, not in yen terms, John. Just kidding. I love Dennis Gartman. But in fact, I think he's not too far from you guys, maybe. Or he's in North Carolina, actually, I think, not South Carolina. But he preaches all the time about metals. I like them as a diversity from just straight stock investing to have exposure to the metals, whether it's silver or gold. What do you think? I'm not saying you guys make this allocation for the customers, perhaps you do, but what do you think a prudent hold is for a percentage of somebody's portfolio in metals?
So, I mean, it's different now than it would have been for most of the last decade. So, you know, the only time when we think it makes any damn sense at all to allocate something like that is when you have materially negative real short-term rates. Right, so you know, and right now, you know, the 2-year yield is 20 basis points, and inflation is running 1.5%. Call it, and inflation, or if you want to look at inflation swaps, they're telling you about the same thing. We're on a forward-looking basis, so you know that means that the real, you know, real interest rates are somewhere around -1% when you know, so interest rate minus inflation. When that happens, there does become a pretty solid relationship between the price of precious metals, especially gold, and those level of negative real rates. And so we don't think, well, it's really hard to envision a positive real rate, at least during the rest of this presidency, probably during the entire next presidency. It's probably, you know, you're probably looking at the third president now before we have a shot to get positive real rates again. And because the Fed's not moving for at least 5 years and probably more like 10. If that is the case, then rates are pinned in the neighborhood of zero, you know, maybe 50 basis points. And inflation is going to be somewhere above that. If that's the case, then holding a zero-yielding asset like gold doesn't hurt you. It actually can help you. And so in those types of cases, gold, if you think about it as kind of an inflation-protected cash, that's a reasonable holding. We probably wouldn't do anything more than 5 or 6% in something like gold. Maybe a different story if you're talking about something like GDX or the junior gold guys, because then you're harvesting not only some sort of real rate premium associated with holding something like gold, but you're also harvesting some of the equity risk premium, which you think can make some sense as well. So if you want to go more than about 5%, probably something having some equity component associated with it would probably make more sense in our view. But we actually, you know, we don't really hold gold or do a whole lot with it in the portfolios because it tends to be over long periods of time fairly inconsistent with a goals-based mandate. We think that for certain people and for certain types of positions, it can be, you know, it probably has some pretty nice prospects so long as real rates are negative. And that's going to be the case for a while.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm sure Peter Schiff and Bill Fleckenstein, who we had on the show earlier this week, would absolutely agree. For myself right now, Scott, I've got about 4% of the real metal and about the same percentage in the miners. And I write calls against the miners. I don't write calls against the futures or against the actual physical gold that I have. But so I guess
I'm not, that's called expensive right now, right?
Yeah. Well,
calls on those are really high. So those are probably the most expensive things you got.
Yep.
That's great. So that's great.
Yep. I'm happy with the allocation. When you guys are looking at some of the things that pop up, and you're going to do an execution, and you're spreading it across, of course, all the portfolios that you guys hit, separately managed and so forth, which based on what you described is somewhere between maybe $4 billion or whatever across all those different accounts. That's probably where a firm like Wallach Beth comes in pretty big, because in some cases, the liquidity you guys are going to be seeking isn't really on the screen. You know that it's out there and that there's interest, but you don't know how much of it you'd be able to access from the screen trade alone. So maybe if you could walk us through what a broker's broker would do for you. I'm making it a commercial for Wallach Beth, of course, but what any good broker's broker would do in terms of getting you that liquidity that you need, because like I say, you don't always see it on the screen.
No, John, you're absolutely right. And especially in the case of ETFs, I mean, you know, the kind of last place you go for liquidity in ETFs is the liquidity you see on the screen. But there, you know, there's all sorts of ways to replicate the payout of an ETF. Folks can do it with a basket. You can do it with some linear combination of liquid futures. So, you know, I know people trade HYG, the high yield ETF, with some linear combination of SPOOs and treasury futures. You know, there's all sorts of things you can do to make markets with ETFs. And with what a firm like Wallach Beth is able to do is actually access all those different types of folks that look at the world differently. So if we need to buy or sell, you know, $100 million of a high yield ETF, you know, if you look on the screen, you know, maybe there's a million on the bid or the offer. It's not, you know, it's really kind of nothing there. So you have to go to people and say, you know, this is where I am. This is what I want to do. And the way that their book is set up, the way their inventory is set up, combined with how they look at that particular product, whether it's a kind of replication, whether it's with the ETF itself, or whether it's some kind of hedging technique, you know, it will really determine the kind of market they can make in it. And so, you know, whereas one day they might be make a great bid in it, the next day they might be a terrible bid in it, just because the way that their book is kind of rolling around. We're never going to know that. And, you know, Horizon Investments just is not in the position to have that kind of information. It's just not what we do every day for a living. But Wallach Beth is, and so, you know, by accessing and by using a firm like Wallach Beth, you know, they're able to kind of know who is doing who's making good bids or offers on these types of securities today, or how are they positioned, or what did they do yesterday or last week that might set them up to be a natural on the other side of a trade like that. You know, that just that kind of institutional knowledge is incredibly valuable to us and our clients, obviously. And so, you know, like using folks like them allows us to access that kind of expertise that we alone, you know, like we might be a bunch of smart guys, but we don't, you know, it's just not the market we play in. And so, we use a bunch of smart guys that do play in that market, and to the benefit of both us and our customers. And so it's, you know, it's a really nice relationship. We've known them for over a decade and been using them a ton. And it's for that reason. They get great execution, and, you know, really good market knowledge. And by the way, they're awesome dudes.
Yep. I agree. Now, how often, if at all, do you get solicited on one of those trades? So for instance, let's say they had another client that was, and that just to pick one, let's say that you were doing something in the miners, in the GDX, and they knew that they'd executed for you in the last couple weeks, and all of a sudden a trade comes in from the other side and they give you a call, Scott, and they say, hey, does Horizon have any interest in the following? How does that conversation go? And has that triggered a trade with you guys when that happens?
They will call us with stuff like that. You know, we don't respond a ton to it. It doesn't fit for us all the time, because we're not really a market making kind of shop. We're more of a positioning kind of shop. And so when we trade, it's because we're needing to do a position change, or our investment views have changed for some reason. And so it's not necessarily responding to shows like that is moving the needle for us. But even if we don't respond to it, or even if it doesn't fit for us for any reason, it's not a never. It's just not a frequent sort of occurrence for us. Even that is, even without, you know, executing on something like that, just the knowledge that these are the types of things, transactions that are going on in the marketplace, can be really helpful color. And even if there's nothing for us to do physically with it, the knowledge that this kind of activity is going on, can spur some research on our side. Say, what's somebody else seeing? Like, why are they doing this? And that always can lead to a research avenue that can be fruitful for us and end up leading to a change in our thought process.
Do you guys have a lot of internal analysts, Scott, within Horizon, or are you relying on third-party outside folks, or a combination thereof?
It's a combination. So there are 15 folks on our investment team. A bunch of PhDs, a bunch of old derivatives traders like myself. We've got our regular traders. We've got single stock guys. We've got computer science guys. It's kind of a mishmash of people from really disparate backgrounds that come together and try to figure out what the world's saying and make investment decisions based on that. That team aspect of it and the fact that we all have very different starting places for our analysis, very different backgrounds, ends up making kind of a fun investment room. There's a lot of conversations that happen because somebody, like our FX guy will see something and he's like, well, do you realize that means X, Y, and Z? And I'm sitting there like, I have no idea. No, I don't understand that. Explain it to me, please. But just having that sort of cross section of backgrounds is a really powerful tool for us. And we're trying to figure out what the market's telling us.
So when we talk about algorithmic trading and high frequency and so forth, obviously that's not you guys. I understand, and hopefully the listeners and viewers have been understanding what you're saying, that you guys are position traders. You're not market making. You're not DRW or Virtu or Citadel, where you're sitting there reacting to and trading, millisecond by millisecond. You guys are positioning to hold that position and to reap some of the reward that you've already described. For instance, being short those index, that index vol versus some of the constituent vol and so forth. But has that volatility and the in some cases, I'll say illiquidity in those markets, because when I look at those markets, and I'm not always calling Wallach Beth, I probably talk to those guys once a week, but when I'm just looking at the market and trading and so forth, a lot of times that's pretty thin because they understand, those high frequency firms and the algorithmic traders, that if you put a bid or an offer out there, you're basically giving somebody information for free. They don't like doing that. So they post very little up there on the screen. And does that, is that something that has hindered some people, perhaps not you guys, because of what you've already said about using Wallach Beth and so forth to seek the liquidity, but is that something you think that impacts the market in a negative way, that the displayed liquidity is so low these days?
John, I think you hit on one of the most important topics that's out there right now. Yeah, liquidity, however you want to measure it, and you've been around a long time too, and I know you can just feel it. But even if you quantitatively measure these things, liquidity is in the basement, and it's been in the basement since the kind of the VIX blow up in February of 18. It's a lot of reasons because of what you just highlighted. Market makers today are algo shops. It's not banks. It's not specialists, obviously. It's folks that are, and that's not necessarily, that's not by by its nature evil, but algo shops are probably the most VAR sensitive entities in the marketplace, and incredibly volatility and VAR sensitive entities, and what that means for our listeners is that when volatility gets high, they just pull back. Think about the pit option trader in October of 87, just like not seeing guys that wanted to trade with them. Like you just turn your back and you don't see them, you don't trade, right? This is the kind of modern day equivalent of something like that. And it's part of the reason why we've got these really, really sharp V type of markets that we experienced both in 18, fourth quarter of 18, first quarter of 19, and the last 3 or 4 months. The sharpness of these V markets we've seen is a direct relation to the really crummy liquidity situation that we found ourselves in, and it's partly because the market makers, not only in S&P, not only stock futures and stock markets, but now even in the treasury market, we're starting to detect it. like treasury futures market, that, you know, that when things get really hairy, the guys, just markets aren't there. So, you have $5 million of stock to move, you're gonna push boost 3 points. Like, that's, you got $100 million of stock to move, you're gonna push it 10 points. And guess what? That's gonna induce other types of behavior and other kinds of activity. So, you know, you get this really nasty negative feedback loop associated with you know, continuing market movements or markets that continue the same direction, because there's just a really crummy liquidity environment out there that's dominated by the ball sensitive guys. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. So, you know, I think that we do need to set ourselves up, you know, like intellectually or sort of philosophically, I think we got to start preparing for much more frequent and much more sharp V markets, which you can be able to take advantage of if, you know, if you have this tank pattern, you got some stomach and you understand the phenomenon that's driving the why is it being this sharp on the way down and then also on the way back up. You know, understanding what, like, why that's happening, you know, might give you a little bit of insight as to how to trade through something like that or how to manage through something like that. But just like looking at it from the top view, you know, that might be something that scares you. But if you understand that it's largely a liquidity function that's driving the sharpness of some of these moves, especially in March and April, you know, that might be a helpful perspective for some of our viewers.
Well, last question for you is really just about how much you guys trade, not trade, how much, you know, the executions you guys do, let's say on a monthly basis, about what percentage of it is options and what percentage is either those ETFs that you described or the indexes that you're trading. If you want to break it down between stock and options, fine, but what sort of numbers are we looking at there for a $6 billion portfolio that you guys run through all of your businesses?
It's probably about 75% ETFs, probably 10 or 15% single stocks in the remainder and derivatives-based securities. And so, it, you know, the bulk of what we do is in the ETF market. It does supply some really nice liquidity characteristics, especially in like fixed income or foreign markets. Some really attractive characteristics with respect to how you can access previously inaccessible markets like that. And so, you know, the bulk of our trading ends up being ETF based, the large majority of it. But it's something that is very, very time dependent for us. So it's very market dependent on how fast and how much we're going to trade. So a year like 2017, when like nothing moved except for like 3 basis points up every day and everything, like that was all that happened. I think we traded twice the entire year across all the portfolios. A year like this, a little bit more. We traded pretty much every day for about 6 weeks, and not necessarily small trades. So our trading activity level is really dictated by the environment that we find ourselves in, and that is a result of being not necessarily a market making kind of presence, more of a positioning taking kind of presence.
Beautiful. Hey, Scott, you've done a great job explaining for our viewers and listeners exactly what a firm like Horizon does, and I really can't thank you enough. I hope you guys have continued success and that it's a great rest of 2020 for you. As crazy as 2020 has been, it has been, as I've said as well, one of the best trading years that I've ever seen. And I know you guys are managing, not trading as much, but still it's been a great year for trading. And I agree with Scott's observations, folks, about we're likely to see a lot more of this, a lot more of those sharp moves in the market because of both high frequency and algorithmic trade and so forth. So Scott Ladner of Horizon Investments, the CIO there. Scott, thank you very much for your time today.
John, I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon.
All good.
Beautiful. Scott, that was fantastic. I hope I didn't keep you too long away from the market.
This is awesome. I love talking to you. Love at least kind of chatting virtually a little bit. Hope we can have a beer sometime.
I hope so too. And I made the mistake of saying I thought you were in South Carolina, but obviously Charlotte's in North Carolina. But
nobody knows that. It doesn't matter.
when you're dyslexic, apparently it affects geographic. Not just letters on a page or something, but thank you very much. Please give my best to all the folks down there.
I will, dude. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world.
Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.